The Serial Entrepreneur, brought to you by Startups Magazine. A podcast bringing you leading businesses and founders who have a story to tell and explain some of their biggest challenges.
Try not to be too hard on yourself. Like, I meet so many founders who are like, you know, I should have done this, and then the pandemic happened and I didn't do this. And you spend so much time like second guessing yourself when really mistakes will happen. Like, we're human.
It really does improve over time, and I think sometimes when you're starting out, you kind of almost expect yourself to have, you know, super high standards from the start. You know, you want to do your best at the start, absolutely, but you're never going to be perfect.
Plus, share their biggest secret, their favourite breakfast cereals.
My favourite cereal is an Australian cereal called Nutri-Grain.
Rice Krispies.
It's pretty boring. Weetabix.
I have a clear winner. It is Cocoa Pops.
Hello and welcome back to the Serial Entrepreneur podcast, as always with your host Anna Flockett. And today I'm really excited to be in the company of a very talented lady, Lauren Curry, OBE. Lauren is the founder of Upfront, also a speaker, a writer, but most passionately about confidence and people, and is on a mission to change the confidence for 1 million women by 2023. What a challenge. Lauren, it's such a pleasure to have you with me today. First of all, how are you?
Hi, Anna. I'm super good. I've had a long Easter weekend and the sunshine. The sun is still shining. I've had a very dark winter in Sweden. So I'm like truly living my best life when the sun is shining.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm so fascinated as well by the fact that you live over in Sweden. Do you guys have summertime savings? So like the clock's gone forward over there and made the days like brighter and lighter?
Yeah, it's quite amazing. Quite a thing to get used to. And it's still, you know, eventually it'll still be light at like 11:30 at night, which is, you know, just so tempting to drink wine and gin and tonic all the time. I guess it's the extreme both ways. You know, the dark nights are very short, very dark, very cold, and the summer nights are a wonder. So yeah, we moved here a year and a half ago from London. I'm obviously Scottish, as you can tell. So yeah, I've got a wee boy who's 4, and he goes to a Swedish school, and he can already speak Swedish, so he's ahead of me in that sense. I'm still doing my Duolingo and have lessons once a week.
Oh, it sounds like such an amazing lifestyle over there. And I'll probably will probe you more about that throughout our conversation, okay, into the life of Lauren. But before we jump into that, my first and arguably most important question for you is, as it is the Serial Entrepreneur podcast, what is your favourite breakfast cereal and why?
Oh, I think my favourite breakfast cereal is probably a muesli. You know, I like nuts and seeds and oats and the kind of earthy wholesomeness that comes with that. Yeah.
I was thinking very wholesome and healthy, but also very lovely sometimes. So yeah, good solid start and conversation. You and your business, you are all about people, power, the confidence. I've been listening to some of your other podcasts. I've been listening to your TED Talk you did back in 2017. We'll get onto all of that. And you're so inspiring. But you actually started, correct me if I'm wrong, in design. Talk me through how it all started. Where did you go and study? And why did you go and study to become a designer?
Of course. So I think I was really, really lucky in that I had a teacher at secondary school who really saw me, I guess. You know, you talk about when a teacher makes you feel very seen, and he was called Mr. Grant. I hope he's listening. He's definitely not. But every now and again, I text him like, Mr. Grant, you're amazing. So he was my art teacher. And I remember I was probably 14, and he showed me the portfolio of a chap a couple of years above me who'd redesigned a TV remote control to make it work for people with arthritis. And I remember just having such a moment of realizing, holy shit, like every single thing that we use and touch has been designed by somebody. That's somebody's job to make that thing. So that was my kind of first phase of being obsessed with product design, you know. So I was like, I'm going to go to art school. I'm going to be the next James Dyson, Steve Jobs. I'm going to design an object that will change the world and make me rich. And so I went to Duncan of Jordanston Art School in Dundee, in the east coast of Scotland. And very quickly into my studies there, discovered this thing called service design. So I remember we had a lecture that was all about design against crime, which was my second kind of big light bulb moment, when our professor was telling us, you know, there are things, the way that you design public spaces, the way that you design communication, all of those things connect to form a system and they influence people's behavior. You know, a very simple example would be how signage is designed in a hospital. You know, some of us will have been in those moments when you're frantically trying to find your way around, and that sign can make or break that experience being a good or bad one. So at that time, service design was a very kind of unknown, emerging, immature discipline. And I was really attracted to it because it was looking at the whole journey end to end of people interacting with all sorts of services, from, you know, booking a holiday right through to trying to pay your council tax, or, you know, trying to find the right doctor for your family, or whatever that might be. And that was, you know, there was definitely a fire was lit that day that will never go out, which I think is my dedication to building experiences, services that work, that delight people, that deliver value time and time again. And I was really drawn to, what does that look like for in a public sector environment when you're thinking about the NHS, our local government services, our education services, our health services. So I essentially, you know, made my 4 years of study at university, and then I did a year of a master's degree on top of that. I designed it to train myself in this practice that wasn't really something that you could go and study. And I did that in a way that was very open. So I blogged a lot, I shared a lot of my work online, and that meant that I had a very strong kind of network and was building a reputation in the industry before I'd even graduated, which led to me then setting up one of the very first kind of service design for social good consultancies in the UK. So that was my very first business that I set up in 2008, straight after I graduated.
Wow. It sounds like people have always been at the forefront of like your drive in life, even like obviously now we're going to come on to Upfront and that side of the business, which is people focused. But even when you were looking at the design, it was always like the people that you were thinking about, which is obviously like a lovely kind of like trait and passion to have. I say passion because it's very clear that obviously you are passionate about that. So talk me through then becoming kind of like involved in the more entrepreneurial world and kind of starting and founding Upfront.
Yeah, so I think my, you know, my exposure to that world, I think, was very, you know, I would read the Steve Jobs books, the Richard Bransons, the James Dysons. I sometimes have a tantrum to myself imagining how things would have played out differently if I'd read books from women entrepreneurs and women engineers, but they weren't really, you know, accessible then. They were definitely there, of course. And my mum is definitely entrepreneurial. She's always had side hustles, kind of multiple income streams. She's a very crafts-based artist. So she usually had, you know, a sales job during the day, and then she would make products that she would sell on the side and kind of do that at night. So I think I was exposed to the kind of selling and the hustling side of things in terms of, you know, setting up a business, being commercially minded. That was all very new. I was the first person in my family to go to university. You know, we grew up in a deprived area in Scotland. I wasn't I didn't have people around me who ran businesses who talked about money or impact. So the business that I set up after university was very much, you know, we had one client, did a great project, got another client, did another great project, and it very much snowballed organically. And I ran that for 7 years. And then I think that business was very focused on Scotland and kind of small scale of Scotland that at first felt incredibly motivating and like we can really make a difference here, started to feel quite claustrophobic. And I was kind of tired of being the person who was running. I used to say I'm always running the events. I'd like to just go to one for a change. And I had an experience with the entrepreneurial program at MIT in Boston. I was chosen to kind of go on this course, and I think that was another very big kind of light bulb moment, turning point for me, because it was the first time I felt like what it was like to be in a room of peers and people who were thinking bigger than me, rather than being in the room where you're the person with the big idea and you're the person trying to bring other people along with you. So I've set up, you know, multiple ventures and projects over the years since then, kind of first focused on service design. And then my attention kind of shifted into organizational design, which I think is the very natural progression of, okay, now we've designed these services and systems. It's the invisible organizational matter, if you like, that exists around that service, like leadership, team dynamics, team culture. You know, when you look at companies like Airbnb and Spotify, they're starting to talk about, we need to really intentionally design our culture the same way we intentionally design our product. So I spent a couple of years working in that space, serving much more private sector clients and kind of FTSE 100 organizations. And kind of halfway through that journey, found myself in a position where I would get invited to be on stage, I would give talks, my name was on fancy lists, and I was totally naive, wasn't really thinking about feminism very much, definitely wasn't thinking about anti-racism, and just didn't understand why I was usually the only woman in the room, why I was always the only person with a regional accent, usually the only person who didn't go to private school, always the youngest person. And there was a keynote that I gave at a conference in Bristol where I was the only woman speaker over the whole day. And of course, now I would never have said yes to that, and I would hope that that would never happen. But in 2016, I did say yes, because I didn't know any better, frankly. And it was a day when I decided to be brave, because it did feel like there was a potential of backlash or potentially upsetting people, but I decided to kind of call it out in my talk and say, why are there no women up here? Like, why am I looking at an audience that's extremely diverse and representative, and yet everybody on the stage is white and it's me and like 10 dudes in their 40s? Like, what is with that? And there was a huge response. You know, the audience really connected with that. Lots of people wanted to talk to me about it. I put a post-it note in the women's toilets that said, would you like to be on stage one day? Tweet me and talk to me about it. My Twitter was on fire. And I think that was the day that Upfront was born. Like, that was the day that I realized there is an intense, complicated problem to be solved here. And we cannot continue the way we are. You know, I cannot continue to be somebody who just grumbles about this. I need to try and make this better, which I think is very much part of my design training. Like, that's what you get taught when you go to art school, is you learn how to learn through doing and how to build experiments to test your ideas. So that's what that day became. You know, that was my first kind of day of experimenting, if you like, really listening for the insights in those conversations. And I realized that the, like, as I said, fundamentally complex, nuanced and intersectional, but also people are just shit scared of being on a stage. Like, they're just like, there's just no way I would ever stand on a stage. You would not get me up there for love nor money. Like, I'm no, that's a thing that other people do. And I was really fascinated by this. I'm like, what is it about standing up on a raised platform to have lots of people look at you? You know, and I'm naturally performer, extroverted, storyteller. So I'm lucky that the kind of form that society has decided to create for these stories to be told is actually one that I feel quite comfortable in. And I know that that's definitely not the norm. So I had lots of conversations, had lots of ideas, and thought, how can we speed up the journey people go on to realizing it's not as scary as they think it is? Because when you talk to somebody who's done it for the first time, second time, they're kind of over that hurdle. That's the first thing they'll always say. Wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be. So the first phase of Upfront was a big red sofa. Let's get it on stage so that when people like Anna is given a keynote at Startup Magazine, you can say, hey, ticket holders, anybody here got stage fright, hates the idea of being on stage, come and hang out on my Upfront sofa. I'll look after you. You don't need to say anything. And you will acclimatise. You'll get to be on the other side without all the scary stuff. And so that's what we did. And that was the first iteration of Upfront, which has evolved over the years and is now an organisation with a team of 12 people. I went full-time a year ago, so it was my side hustle for 5 years. And we're, as you said, we're on a mission to support 1 million women with confidence.
It's incredible. And I love the story. I mean, I was in your, as I say, I was watching your TED Talk. And obviously you had a sofa there with five people on. And one was like a musician who was scared about being up on stage. And one, but one day when I was playing at Wembley, and one was about, you know, giving a presentation themselves at a later date, and all different stories, all different people. And I thought, what a great idea is that? And yeah, I love that you've gone for it. I love that it's something so different and it is really helping people, because it, like, as you were telling the stories, I was like, this is exactly how I felt. This is exactly what I say to people when they now say, well, how do you get up on stage? It's not as bad as you first think. The more you do it, the better it gets, the easier it gets. It's just like a psychological thing that is like a barrier to yourself. So I love it. I love everything about it. As you say, it's kind of evolved. So how have the last like 5 years been, and kind of talk me through all the different peaks and troughs that you've been through and where you kind of are at with it now?
Gosh, so many peaks and troughs. Yeah, I think it has been, it's been one of constant prototyping and refining. So, you know, the couch, so that was, as you can imagine, there was no business. Nobody got paid. There was no model. You know, at one point I had a grand idea of like, IKEA will give us a sofa, and then like Barclays will sponsor the four seats on the sofa. And, you know, I'm sure there's something in there, but I couldn't figure it out at the time. And it actually was quite a lot of work. It was a lot of work to make, primarily because the most important thing for me was that the people on the sofa had a really positive experience. And I learned through testing it out that if the speaker's not briefed super well and they're not briefed really well and the compere of the event, like, it all needed to be really set up properly so that they would have a wonderful experience. And that took work and time. But we ended up having, I think, over 500 people all around the world, like Australia, Hong Kong, the States, across Europe. And my mum made like Upfront cushion covers that we would post to the conferences so that they could put an Upfront cushion on their couch. And I would then have, you know, we would send the people a survey and we would have a debrief call. And this, the data we started to get was really painting quite a remarkable picture. You know, it was saying that just by sitting there for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, they were now saying, I'm 30% more likely to put myself forward to speak at an event one day. Their perception and understanding of their own potential to be a speaker totally transformed. And so when I would have these calls with people, they'd be absolutely buzzing, bouncing off the walls, so excited. Like, Lauren, oh my God, this then, do you have an upfront podcast? Do you have a workshop? Do you have a book? And I'm sitting thinking, nope, don't have any of those things. So, you know, and all this is while I'm, you know, day job and running my other business. So I started to play with the idea of running workshops, because when I looked out into the market, I just saw a huge opportunity, because essentially you've got two options. You've got the kind of Gary V, Tony Robbins, like hustle and crush people, which, you know, not fit for purpose and problematic, I think. And then you've got the kind of Royal Academy of Dance that's, you know, we'll learn this through body and breath. And I think, yes, absolutely necessary, but also quite inaccessible for a bunch of different reasons. So I wanted to build a workshop that was centered on the idea that women do not need to change ourselves. We do not need to fix ourselves. We actually don't have a problem with confidence. What we have is we live in a world where we are punished for being confident, and therefore we change our behavior accordingly to avoid that punishment. And so the workshop was almost a mashup of my design and facilitation training, my leadership knowledge. I partnered up with some actors and some improv people. So it was a real blend of kind of mindset and practicality stuff. And people just absolutely loved them. They sold out every time. So this was before I had a baby. So I convinced my employer to let me use their office in South London at the weekend. And we would push all the furniture to the sides. It's really funny now I remember it. At the time I was just like, right, move all the furniture, get a kettle, put up some signs, welcome to the upfront workshop space. And then businesses started to hear what we were doing, and we would get emails saying, you know, can you come and run this session for my team at Co-op? Can you come and run this session for my team at Accenture? So at this point I'm thinking, okay, maybe we could make some money here. Maybe we could, this is a business, like what might this look like? And those workshops, you know, we used to run them for teams. We used to run them just for women and non-binary people. And I started to really get the itch around, you know, we're limiting ourselves by this being on, like, in person in London. I was so, it was so clear to me we needed an online equivalent. And I sat on that idea for 3 years. I convinced myself it'll never work on the internet. It's so much about being together and the presence and the conversations and the vulnerability. That'll never work online. Or, and you know, the classic, well, who am I? I don't have a PhD in confidence, so who am I to? Which, you know, really is extraordinary now that we are where we are. So it took me a long time to build the online course on the side because I had a baby and then there was a pandemic, and you know, but we launched a 6-week online version of that workshop in summer 2020, and not really knowing how it would go or what would happen. So we had a bunch of pre-recorded videos and made a Facebook group for the community to talk to each other. And I think over 200 people signed up, and it was extraordinary. I mean, the transformation, the feedback, the data, the life-changing stories. And so now we've had over 1,000 women from over 50 countries have gone through our 6-week program. Each cohort is called a bond. So bond is the collective noun for a group of women. Bond 6 starts in June. So we are gearing up for that. We've already had 213 folks have signed up. And we work with incredible businesses like Nike and Pleo and Just Eat Takeaway and charities like Citizens Advice, British Red Cross. And we are truly making a dent in how these organisations understand what confidence is, how we need to work together to build team cultures, organisational cultures, where all sorts of confidence is celebrated and rewarded, loud and quiet, soft and gentle. You know, we need to move away from this very narrow discipline of confidence that is extremely limiting. It's extroverted, it's white, it's loud, it's usually aggressive. And you'll know that so many women make it their life's mission to be, to avoid that label, so much so that they disappear.
Yeah. I mean, what you're doing, like I've said a million times now, is incredible, giving other people confidence, and like to see your confidence and like how much you've achieved is amazing. But even yourself, and you were like, I convinced myself that an online course, your confidence, like you absolutely saved it, and then you smash it, and you know, you talked yourself around that, and you found that confidence in yourself to go for it. So you've proven that this obviously is a success and that you can do it. But it's so funny that even like, you know, the people with the most confidence can suffer that imposter syndrome a little bit. And it can happen to anyone and everyone at any time. And you've really got to dig deep, I think, like you did, and really go for it. Yeah, I just thought that was really incredible, obviously, that you were kind of like a working prodigy on yourself, and you really decide.
And I think that's part of what makes the bond experience so powerful, is that people turn up with this very fixed, well, people like me have low confidence and people like them over there have high confidence. It's understanding that confidence is not something that's innate. It's not something you're born with. And it's something that ebbs and flows for everybody, regardless of your seniority, how much money you have, where you live, what your background is, any of these things. But there are real tried and tested techniques and strategies that you can use to ride that wave, if you like, and realize that there is no final destination. It's not like I'm going to do this X, Y, and Z, and then I'm a confident person. Like, that's not how it works. It's been on this constant journey of the peaks and troughs, and having the, and knowing what you need to ride that wave, I think.
Yeah. And like you said, confidence will look different for everyone. So like some people, what they want to achieve or what they maybe can achieve will be different to what other people want to and what they can achieve. But obviously, like we've said, it is such a massive issue for a lot of people. It's definitely an issue for everyone at some point. Will some people never get over it, you know, or do you believe everyone can be helped and everyone can improve on their confidence?
I believe everybody can make progress and everybody can get to a place where they feel proud of their confidence. 100%. Yeah,
I think it's such a conversation that everyone has experienced and knows what it is, but like it's just not spoken about a lot, and to see like a whole business built around it is just incredible. Going back to your TED talk, I know I've referred to it so many times, I was just in awe of it. One of my favorites. You also referred to yourself as ambassador of people, which again, you spoke about at the beginning. It seems to be a massive part of you and your kind of like central person, and that you have a passion and power of people. I love that. What is your kind of end goal? Like, when will you sit back and say kind of like, I've really done my job here. Like, I am proud of what everything I have done.
Gosh. I mean, I think I know myself well enough now to know that that day will probably never come. That I absolutely do feel very proud now, you know, and I do sometimes have to intentionally work at feeling that and kind of recognizing that and sharing it. And it's getting meta now, but I feel proud of, you know, I used to be really bad at that. You know, I think it's a very classic kind of high achiever Catholic upbringing, you know, this kind of can be difficult to internalize achievements. So that's something that I've had to, you know, kind of work hard at. And I think in terms of, you know, where is it going? The story I often tell is about how would the world feel different and be different if we achieved what we want to achieve? And the story I always tell is, imagine living in a world where the reason that a woman doesn't do the thing she wants to do is never lack of confidence. Because when you look at the data, whether it's around, well, you'll know this, starting a business, growing your business, taking your business to another sector, another country, all these things, the main reason that doesn't happen is usually confidence in the founder and from the team. Buying a house, traveling, having a baby, ending a relationship that's not serving you anymore. All of these, when you look at all these things, this, like returning to work after a break or returning to work after maternity leave is also a big one. The number one reason that people don't do those things is lack of confidence. And usually the second or third reason people don't do those things is lack of community. And we exist to eradicate those two things. And I think if you take those away, that's when you change the world, because you now have millions of women who are doing the thing that they want to do. And it doesn't really matter too much what that thing is. It matters that they're doing the thing that they want to do, and that they are trusting themselves to take that leap, to make the investment, to say yes, to write the book, you know, whatever that looks like. You know, there's definitely a personal element to that question, which I think about. And I think for me, it's a lot about freedom. It's like, I want to build an organization that will give me and my family freedom to choose what we work on when, to choose where we live when. You know, I think that is all, that is the ultimate end goal, to do all of these things in a way that is contagious and replicable, which I think that's what I'm doing. You know, people are the women in the bonds, the women in our community. And even if you're not in the bond or you're not in your community, you know, the people listening here today or people who might read my newsletter or follow me on Instagram, you know, you'll take from it the seeds and the nuggets, and it might mean a promotion, a pay rise, a saying no to the job that's not right for you. But it's putting yourself first in a world that has taught you to put yourself last.
Yeah. I was going to say, when you were kind of talking there, and it's a little bit deep, but we kind of got a bit deep in that, and I like that. Do you think that society has been not created, maybe created, has learned that we should put women's confidence down more than men's?
Oh my gosh, 110%. All of the data shows us that women and men both respond negatively to women who portray confidence.
And I know I don't want to bring it back to necessarily all about like vanity or looks, but I saw something on Instagram literally this morning, and it was, I think it was at a gym, and there was changing room doors, and there was the men's door said like, do epic things, and the female changing door said, smile, you're losing weight. And I just thought, you're putting her confidence down already because you're saying that she needs to lose weight. She's not in the gym to gain or to do anything, whereas men are there to just do amazing things. And straight away, you're knocking one confidence and building the other. It blew my mind that was still a thing in 2022. But
it's very much still a thing. And it's very much intersectional. You know, it's very much worse for Black women, worse for brown women, worse for gay women, worse for trans women. You know, I think that's also a big part of when we talk about changing confidence, not women, is understanding that white women in particular have got a huge role to play in making women more equal. It's like women are not any more equal than women and men are. There's huge disparities amongst women, and it's not about, you know, let's teach women to work towards this version of success in the way that men have role modeled, because very clearly that is not working. You turn on the TV channel, we can see vast examples of ways that that is not working. But I think the way that I always encourage people to think about it is to try and look back to your childhood, think about your earliest memory of trying to hide the fact that you were clever. And if you ask men to do that, it's a very different conversation, because men are, you know, the gender norms are intensely harmful, and they start from a very, very young age. And the narrative of it is a woman's role to keep the peace, to play nice, to not rock the boat, is ingrained from a very early age. And everybody will have their own version of what that is. So for me, growing up near Glasgow, it was very much like, who does she think she is? You know, a show off was the worst criticism that you could ever imagine. And you'll have your own version of that. Every woman does. And that's why we use the word revolution, you know, very intentionally.
Yeah, definitely. Well, on that note, before I wrap up the conversation, although I could sit here talking to you all day, it's been a good one today. I just wanted to briefly mention your OBE and ask you obviously a little bit about what it was in and when that was and how it felt. And yeah, it's just such an incredible achievement.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a funny one, because I, folks who know me listening will know that I do not support or advocate for the royal family in any way. And I believe we can never achieve equality under a monarchy, fundamentally. Having said that, and with that in mind, you know, this award was an incredible gift for me to give my family. And, you know, when I think about what makes me proudest around that, it's my parents. You know, my parents have been incredibly supportive. My dad, very supportive from a, I don't really know what you're on about, but I think you're great and this is great. My mum, supportive from a, living the peaks and troughs, how did the client meeting go, did you get the next contract, like so in it for a long time. And the OBE was something that from their point of view was just very, it's something that everybody recognises. It's something that my dad could tell the guy at the local shop and the postman. And that was just like a really, really beautiful thing. It was also the first that we know of, the kind of spot when I've talked to my peers in the design community, the first award of its kind for service design, which is also extraordinary, because, you know, service design is changing how businesses function. It's you know, we now have teams and teams of service designers inside government. Like, we used to stand on stage and say designers belong in government, and people would be looking at us like we were aliens. And now that's very commonplace. So there was something as well that was special about that. And I actually got the letter whilst I was in bed recovering from a pregnancy loss and pregnancy trauma. So there was also something that felt very like, because I had no idea, you know, this thing just landed through the post. And I ended up the ceremony, I was 8 months pregnant. So mm-hmm. I have a huge tummy, huge bump in the pictures, which I just love, because now Atlas is here and he's four. And
he came with you. He was basically there as well.
Yeah. And he was like, he's like, oh, I'm in there. And, you know, it was fun because they were very like paramedics on site. She can't have a baby on royal soil, or I don't know, you'd be a prince or something weird. So that was fun, and my parents came, and So yeah, I met Prince William and Kate was pregnant at the time. So we had a wee bit of back and forth on, you know, babies are hard, whatever. So from my point of view, it was very much, this will give me power in rooms where I wouldn't normally be taken seriously. Has that happened? I don't know, to be honest. I don't, there's nothing significant that I can share with you that I can point and say that happened because of that. But, you know, it's definitely handy when I'm meeting clients in America or from further afield, because, of course, it's like very fancy and kind of Bridgerton to them. So
it's sometimes nice to just tell people. Lauren, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, as I've said. And I guess, yeah, on the final note, I was going to kind of just say, like, what is next for Upfront and for yourself? But I guess the big next thing that's coming up very soon is the next 6-week program. So where can people find out more about that? Where can people get in touch with you? Where can we point people in your direction?
Yes. So our next bond course starts on June 6th. We still have places. It is 6 weeks online, 3 hours of pre-recorded content and a community, all self-paced. Your behavior, mindset, habits around confidence will be transformed. And we are so excited to welcome so many different people from different sectors and countries. Our last bond was nearly 400 people from over 25 different countries. So to find out more, you've definitely follow me on Instagram, because I love chatting to folks there. I'm really active on there. It's _LaurenCurry_. Also Upfront Global on Instagram. We have a free newsletter that we send out every Tuesday with lots of insights and articles around confidence and visibility. And we've just launched a podcast, so that feels like an exciting thing to share. Episode 2 came out yesterday. So 15 minutes every Monday morning is your Upfront moment to set your week up for, to set your week up with compassion, kindness, confidence, agency. I've said it, it will feel like a warm hug and a kick up the ass at the same time. So you can subscribe and get your Upfront moment every Monday. And if you're curious about the bond course, you know, my team is here to help you decide if it's right for you. We have discounts for NHS staff, discounts for charities and students. It's free if you're on maternity leave. It's free if you live in a household with no income. You can pay over 4 installments. You know, we very much want you to have this experience. So do say hello.
We definitely will do. And we'll be sharing out on all our socials too. So pointing people in the right direction to being upfront about their confidence. Thank you so, so much for being such an amazing guest and for such an enjoyable and serious and deep conversation as well. Thank you.
It's been really nice. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The Serial Entrepreneur, brought to you by Startups Magazine. A podcast bringing you leading businesses and founders who have a story to tell and explain some of their biggest challenges.
Try not to be too hard on yourself. Like, I've met so many founders who are like, you know, I should have done this, and then the pandemic happened and I didn't do this. And you spend so much time like second guessing yourself when really mistakes will happen. Like, we're human.
It really does improve over time, and I think sometimes when you're starting out, you kind of almost expect yourself to have, you know, super high standards from the start. You know, you want to do your best at the start, absolutely, but you're never going to be perfect.
Plus, share their biggest secret, their favourite breakfast cereals.
My favourite cereal is an Australian cereal called Nutri-Grain.
Rice Krispies.
It's pretty boring. Weetabix.
I have a clear winner. It is Cocoa Pops.